Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There were about 25 former long-haul truckers currently serving time in U.S. prisons for multiple murders. One word that has been used to describe the truck-driving serial killer is opportunistic. They live in a shadowy world of constant state-to-state travel, and the so-called visible people that they deal with, some say few would miss them if they disappeared. The FBI is cracking the case and has set up a special unit tracking long-haul truckers who are also serial killers. The FBI Serial Killings Initiative estimates that long-haul truckers are behind an astonishing 850 murders and counting. Frank Figluzzi is the author of Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. He was the assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI, where he served 25 years as a special agent and directed all espionage investigations across the government. And Frank Figluzzi, welcome to The Source.
David, thanks for having me. I'm glad we could have the discussion.
Yeah, and I do want to start off by highlighting the fact that we're not trying to tar and feather all truckers, truck drivers. You know, the vast majority of them are upstanding, law-abiding, good people.
Indeed, that's true. In fact, I partially dedicate my book to the stalwart American trucker who puts food on their family's table by putting food on our table. And thank goodness we're only talking about a tiny fraction of long-haul truckers who are suspected of serial killing. And in fact, you know, on the good side, before we get to the bad side and the ugly side, the economy depends on the critical work of long-haul truckers. Grocery stores would run out of goods in 3 days if truckers stopped trucking. And last year alone, trucking industry brought in $875 billion in gross freight revenue. So they're essential workers. They're good people, many of them with families. But I'm focused, of course, on the dark side of trucking.
But also the trucking industry is trying to be part of a solution to make the roads safer, to address the problem of human trafficking and police in their own ranks. Is that right?
Yeah, this is true. Over the years, for example, truckers have become the eyes and ears in the anti-trafficking movement. And an organization called Truckers Against Trafficking, TAT, actually trains truckers to be those eyes and ears and gives out awards every year for hero truckers. Additionally, the industry, the big truck stop companies like OTA and Love's have gone full force into cleaning up the sex trafficking that is occurring on their properties at their truck stops. And in part, has done a great job as well.
So yeah, I just wanted to set that preamble. We're not talking about all long-haul truckers, but there are people who there's something wrong with them. They are serial killers, and somehow they realized they were attracted to becoming a long-haul trucker. I don't know. It was maybe in the past. I don't know if it's still happening now. But it seemed like there's a lot about that job that would allow them to be predators. Is that right?
Precisely. And yes, the cases still arise, and that's because research tells us that the number one profession of serial killers is long haul trucker. And I ask the question in the book about nature versus nurture, right? And how is a serial killer made? And then who is it and why are they attracted seemingly to long haul trucking? It's an isolated, almost hermit-like existence for many kinds of truckers, little social engagement. And essentially you have a mobile crime scene in that big rig because the truckers are exploiting the seams in law enforcement jurisdictions. They'll grab a victim, almost always a sex trafficked victim, in one jurisdiction. They'll kill and rape her in a second jurisdiction. and they'll dump the body in a third. That's part of what makes this so incredibly challenging for law enforcement.
So a body will be dumped in another state with no ID, and the police there, they don't know who the victim is. They may do a DNA search or whatever, but in the meantime, the trucker has gone elsewhere, and then there is this internal fight over, well, who does this end up on? Whose board does this end up on?
That's true. It's confusing, and often it's even more challenging because in many of these cases, you don't have family members, you know, banging their fist at the on the desk at the police department demanding an update and justice because they don't even know their loved one is missing. As part of a survival mechanism, that family of that sex trafficked victim, who is often drug addicted, often has some mental illness associated with the trafficking, that family, to survive, has often distanced themselves. They grow weary of bailing the loved one out of jail. They grow weary of the overdoses that happen, and they distance themselves. So no one even knows they're missing. There's no ID on many of these bodies, and it literally can take decades. I feature cases in the book where it's 30 years or more before the police can absolutely put a name to a body, let alone find out who killed her.
And so, you know, how prevalent is this problem of serial killers being among long-haul truckers?
Yeah, let's talk some numbers because they were startling to me. With 25 years as an FBI agent, retiring as assistant director, I kind of prided myself on knowing all the nooks and crannies of the FBI. But even I was floored as I developed more and more information on this and took to the road myself, putting my investigator hat on, to learn more about the subcultures involved. But the numbers are, as you mentioned, 850 murders that the FBI knows about along our nation's highways of women, mostly women, and mostly sex trafficked victims. The FBI is quite confident that they are looking at long-haul truckers. As you mentioned, there are 25 long-haul truckers already doing time in prison for multiple homicides, yet that has not solved the cases, nor stopped the cases from happening. We currently are seeing 200 pending unsolved cases in the FBI's Highway Serial Killings Initiative. And when I asked the FBI, okay, 200 unsolved cases, how many suspects are you working right now? The answer was 450.
You got to wonder, when did the FBI begin to jump on this as something that needed to be dealt with? When was this initiative started?
Yep. This goes back, the actual initiative goes back to 2003, 2004. The FBI only publicly acknowledged it in 2009 because they had to. The killings were that numerous. They needed to ask the public for help. But as is often the case, the FBI, when it comes to their support resources of local and state law enforcement, they had to be dragged into this case by a state agency. And I can tell you more about that.
Right. We got to take this break. Our phone lines are open. If you want to call in, do you have some insight to share questions? Give us a call. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're talking about the new book just out, Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Frank Figluzzi. He's the author of a new book, Long Haul, Haunting the Highway Serial Killers, and Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. And he is also the author of a previous book, which was a national bestseller, The FBI Way, Inside the Bureau's Code of Excellence. And he is a national security contributor for NBC News. So, Frank, I hope you don't mind. I want to ask you a question, kind of off topic here, but I wouldn't ask you if I didn't think it was important and we didn't need to kind of flesh this out. Since you're an expert on FBI procedure and policy and things, recently there was a lot of news about when the FBI was forced to raid Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's residence, trying to deal with the stolen classified documents and boxes that the former president denied that he had and would refuse to turn back over to the National Archive. And so in this, there was a story came out recently saying that the FBI had been given orders that they would be able to use deadly force. Can you help us understand what's going on there?
Yeah, I sure can, and I appreciate the opportunity. Look, in 25 years as an FBI agent at varying levels of management and leadership, I have never seen a ops order, as we call them, an operations order that's written before in a search warrant execution or an arrest execution. I've never seen one, and I've seen hundreds of them and approved many of them that didn't include the deadly force policy of the FBI, which is viewed, by the way, as not only mandatory in ops orders as part of a federal form within DOJ that has in its template certain language that you can't remove. So if people were to look in the bottom right-hand corner of the ops order, they'd see a number. That number is the federal form, and that shows you that it's not something people develop out of thin air. The rest of the template you can fill in with the details of your search today, what you're looking for, who's on the team, what their phone numbers are, all of that good stuff. But this is mandatory. It's so required that the same deadly force policy appeared in the Joe Biden consensual search of his residences for classified information. So nobody treated differently here. For those who say, well, this was unprecedented, what's the threat? Why didn't you take the language out? I say to them, are you implying that FBI agents should have been told to keep their guns at home that day, should have gone into a situation unarmed, where throughout the FBI every day, Murphy's Law applies? And in my own career, I've seen people totally unrelated with the search, say a contract employee, think that the FBI is coming for him because he has a warrant. He opens fire on the agents. I've seen agents killed because they thought there was a low threat environment and nobody was armed. I've seen a spouse come down the stairs while her husband was being arrested and fire a shotgun at an FBI agent and kill the agent. So you're armed when you're working. You're working, so you're armed. That's how it works. It's mandatory. What's happening here? I think the far right has glommed onto this as a conspiracy that they think serves them well, but legitimate journalists, once they searched the facts and gotten the reality, are not talking about this anymore because they know it's false.
And to continue that, there are people in the far right who want to defund the FBI. They are encouraging people to challenge the FBI. And as you mentioned, the FBI, they don't play. And it's, if somebody is threatening them, they will respond with deadly force, unfortunately. And people need to know that, don't they?
Yeah, look, there's consequences to actions here. And sadly, over the past several years, we have seen people who are willing seemingly to sacrifice their lives, become martyrs for a cause, or at least for one person that they identify with. So we've seen, for example, a man who tried to breach security of the FBI Cincinnati field office end up being shot dead by law enforcement. We've seen a man in Provo, Utah, who swung a weapon at agents as they tried to arrest him, who was aligned with some violent parts of the MAGA extremism, and he had to be shot dead. This is not good. And so the agents every day are dealing with still arresting people for their participation in January 6th, and those are tactical arrests. Those are people who are assumed to be armed and dangerous.
And so here we are talking about your new book, Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. And this is this is what the FBI does. This is about keeping Americans safe and bringing killers to justice who think they've outsmarted law enforcement by constantly jumping jurisdictions. So how does hunting highway serial killers fit into the overall mission of the FBI?
Yeah, and it's important to answer this question in the context of a question you just brought up, which is, you know, people saying they want to defund the FBI. I would ask them, which parts of the FBI do you wish to defund? The parts that you don't like, the parts where they're pursuing people from your party who might be corrupt, or another party? So this HSK initiative, this Highway Serial Killing Initiative, is run out of the behavioral analysis units at Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI Academy is, and it's staffed by crime analysts who, by the way, are not gun and badge special agents, but rather are using computer algorithms, years of experience, brain power, and liaison with county, local, state law enforcement to try and connect the dots to stop the killing. How did this all start? It started with an Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation crime analyst, a woman named Terry Turner, who's one of the heroes in my book, who years ago, many years ago, would not stay quiet about what she thought was a serial killing series involving missing young women from Oklahoma who were turning up dead around the country. And in the span of just a few months, around 2003, she ended up counting 10 cases out of Oklahoma with women being found dead around the nation. She decided to bring this to her leadership. They finally said, okay, you can call your meeting of homicide detectives from around the country. We'll serve coffee and donuts. Get them in here. She expected maybe 10 people would show up from around the nation with similar cases. She had dozens of detectives show up. And more importantly, she demanded the FBI bring some crime analysts to the meeting. They did. And when the FBI heard of these cases around the country, they said, you have met the criteria for serial killings. Count us in. And that's when the initiative started. 2004, the FBI went public with it in 2009, seeking the public's help.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Michael. And Michael, you're on the air.
I wonder, do we have any idea, any estimation of what the rate of these murders is per year? And is it more now than it was before, and we only are aware of it now, whereas we weren't aware of it in the past? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Michael.
So good question. The numbers are apparently dropping slightly, even though while I was researching and writing this book, I had to stop writing at least twice because I had set Google alerts on my phone to tell me if there was any news reporting on truckers and killings, and my alert went off twice. And I inserted those more recent cases and investigative developments in the book. Here's why it's getting harder to count the numbers today. This problem has moved largely online. What do I mean by that? The advertising for sex for money from trafficked victims and their pimps is happening online. And even as I drove across the nation, 2,000 miles in a big rig, I was checking ads out online. And sure enough, in the cities we went through, and even small towns, there were ads soliciting sex for money and saying, trucker friendly, I come to you or you come to me. And it's happening now in nearby massage parlors and cheap motels adjacent to the truck stop. So what happens is it occurs and there's a dead body found in the motel room or in the massage parlor or in someone's residence, it's not clear that we're dealing with a trucker. So the numbers become hard to count as the crime moves farther away from the truck stop. But yes, I do think the numbers are dwindling. But again, I urge caution because it's getting harder to count.
Well, you know, I can imagine back in the 90s and things, we had a more of an anonymous society. People could move around without being tracked. But today, everyone's got a cell phone on them. That's a tracking device. And we have GPS on our trucks, as you know from your experience when you were doing that background research, riding along. I mean, how anonymous are these people? We know where they are almost all the time.
Great point. Modern trucking has become high-tech. And I was impressed by the use of technology as I rode along in the flatbed for a couple thousand miles. So there's something called the trucker log. There's a trucker app. The owner of your company knows where you are most of the time, knows how fast you're going, even the traffic conditions. Some companies put cameras facing inward into the truck, some and also outward at the traffic through your windshield. So it's hard. And so as I began to theorize, as an investigator does, how to narrow down this 450 suspect pool, I started asking questions like, hey, is it more likely to be an owner-operator who owns his own trucks that's doing this and less accountable? Is it more likely to be a corporate driver? And just as I was kind of concluding that it's less likely to be a corporate, big-time corporate driver, I found cases where that corporate driver parked his rig at the truck stop parking lot for his federally mandated downtime. They're required to take 36 hours of downtime. It's often on a weekend. He parked his rig, he rented an Uber, and went about finding victims and killing them. So you can't, you know, the closer you get to a good theory, you find the case that kind of belies the theory.
And are there other professions similar to long-haul truck drivers that, you know, also enjoy these benefits of unaccountability, dealing with a population largely considered invisible? You know, is there something else out there too?
So if you, first, the research shows us that the number one profession of serial killers is, unfortunately, long-haul trucking by far. Nothing even comes close. When you think about it, the availability of interstate travel access at largely anonymity, you can be in three states in a half a day in some places. That makes it very attractive. And then add in the nature of the job, which is so isolated with very little physical engagement, largely unhealthy. I quote from medical studies of long-haul truckers that have been done, one in Canada that finds the sedentary lifestyle, the lack of healthy food, social engagement, often people faking their mandatory physicals, you know, that you can have a doctor say you're healthy if you slip them a couple hundred bucks. All of that contributes to an unhealthy environment. So there's nothing that comes close with regard to the transience of it and the fleeting nature of it and the opportunity and this kind of collision of trafficking victims along our nation's highways with the truckers who want sex for money.
And it's not an American phenomenon. There's also records of this happening in Europe and in China. It just seems this is a profession that lends itself to people who could be killers.
Yeah, sadly, again, thankfully, we're dealing with only a tiny fat fraction, but that tiny fraction is wreaking havoc on our roads and with law enforcement.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear more about your experience getting in the cab, riding along, trying to understand what life is like for today's modern long-haul trucker. Frank Faguzzi is our guest. His book is The Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is The Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. Our author is Frank Faguzzi, and he is a former FBI assistant director and also the author of the best-selling book, The FBI Way. If you get a question or a comment about long-haul truckers, the few who are serial killers and how they go about committing these crimes, how the police are trying to track them down and get them behind bars and trying to preserve life, give us a call, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. So you do look at Robert Ben Rhodes. He's also known as the truck stop killer. He was on the roads between 1975 and 1990. It's estimated he committed maybe hundreds of murders, although he was only convicted of one, the 1989 murder of Regina K. Walters in Illinois, sentenced to life in prison without parole. What do you want to tell us about Robert Ben Rhodes?
He is amongst the most heinous long-haul trucker killers that I came across. Many say he's the one that everyone, all other killers, would be compared to because of the span and scope of his killing and just the sheer cruelty and evil. So, for example, for your Texas audience, Regina Walters was a 14-year-old girl who was hitchhiking outside of Houston, town of Pasadena, Texas, with her boyfriend. She's picked up, they're both picked up by Robert Ben Rhodes in his truck. The boyfriend is quickly killed by Rhodes. He was a speed bump in the way. And Regina is kidnapped and tortured and raped for several weeks across the country at times and places of Rhodes' choosing. She is hung from the ceiling of his, inside his cab by fish hooks and barbarically tortured. So cruel was Robert Ben Rhodes that he actually anonymously called Regina's father during the abduction period and said, "I've made some changes. I cut her hair." And indeed, when her decomposing body was found in an abandoned farmhouse in Illinois, her hair had been cut short, and she had been wearing a black dress that Rhodes made her wear and high heels that Rhodes made her wear. And even though I've seen about some of the worst crime scenes in FBI history during my career, it's this last image of Regina where Rhodes took a photo of her before he killed her that is so ghastly and so hard to erase, which is she's fully clothed with the cut hair, with the black dress and the high heels, but she has the look of abject fear on her face as her arms are outstretched and hands raised against toward Rhodes, pleading with him to not do it. She knows what's coming, and she's facing death. And this photo is probably the most ghastly photo that I've ever seen.
Robert Ben Rhodes was apparently, he would present himself as a very friendly guy, very disarming, and then he would change automatically once he had them in his clutches.
That's true. And he was finally stopped in Arizona when a state trooper in Arizona saw a rig with its hazard lights flashing on the side of I-10 in Casa Grande. The trooper put on his trooper hat, strolled up to the rig, and heard a woman screaming in back of the rig. He looks at the woman. The woman is shackled to the ceiling of the rig and screaming. And that began the investigation that took down Rhodes. That woman would have been his next murder victim.
The trooper that apprehended Robert Ben Rhodes at that time, handcuffed him. The Rhodes told him, "Hey, we're two adults having consensual sex." The trooper didn't listen to him. He handcuffed him, put behind his back, and put him into the unit as he began his investigation. But when he went back to check on Rhodes, he had managed to get the cuffs in front of him, and he had a handcuff key in his pocket, and he was trying to get to that in order to free himself and to escape. This was a person who not only was he a horrible, a killer and, a serial killer, but he should not be out on the streets.
Clearly not, and he's not. He's in prison, and that's a good thing and a good end to the story, but he may have killed as many as 50 or more victims during his killing spree across the country. I learned from the experts here that there's essentially two kinds of serial killers, and it's true for trucker killers as well. There's the one who wants to control the outcome. They're into power and control, and they prolong the torture and the rape of their victim. That's the case with Rhodes and Regina Walters from Texas. And then second type, they just want to kill. They get off on the killing, and they kill very quickly. And it shows you the pressure on law enforcement to respond to any reports of sightings, missing people, abductions.
Now, so you had him with, you know, with one particular case, and he was convicted of one case and suspected of so many others. How hard is it to actually go beyond suspicion, gather evidence, being able to get a conviction for a long-haul trucker who commits these types of crimes?
It's disturbingly challenging for law enforcement. You've got people, the suspects, who are on the move constantly, and I can sense the frustration amongst the law enforcement officers assigned to these cases because it's a roller coaster of emotion. They get word that some trucker's been arrested halfway around the country. He's done two or three, we think, and now the detectives line up from everywhere to interview that trucker for their own cases, their own murders. And they realize once they get in front of the guy and check the facts that he's got solid alibis. He wasn't there. This happens over and over again. It's very difficult. And only today are we seeing genealogical DNA truly contribute to solving some of these cases.
Now, a lot of these cases happened before we had computer tracking of folks. Are we able to look at a logs at all to find out if particular people were near in the vicinity of a crime that happened maybe in the 1990s?
Oh, indeed. And the companies are cooperative by and large, and technology is our friend in terms of this kind of research. But it is a needle in a haystack. Imagine law enforcement going to all the trucking companies, not just the big ones, but the mom and pop companies, companies that own 2, 3, or 20 trucks, and saying, can we please have your logs, your logistics of all trucks and drivers who were passing this area on this highway, maybe this rest stop, for the last year. Massive amounts of data involved there.
Or even going back 30 years, is that possible?
Most records don't exist going back 30 years, but the cases now being solved that are 30 years old are almost entirely DNA, genealogical DNA that points to a common killer among victims because their DNA is left on the scene. That happens often. Similarly, with the finally identifying the victim by name is also often now being solved through genealogical DNA databases.
So I'm really interested in the case. It's not in your book. It's a guy called the Fast Food Killer, and he terrorized Nashville, where he would go into fast food restaurants as they were closing, and then he would put everyone in the walk-in cooler, and then he would execute them there. But he was from Texas, and he committed similar crimes in Texas, and he was a long-haul trucker for a long, long time. And he, you know, I wonder if there's a 1990, there's a case called the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre, where 9 people were killed in that same fashion. And this guy, you know, crisscrossed the country, and I'm wondering, you know, if he did the same thing all over the country, not just like picking up, you know, women at, you know, truck stops, but doing mass murders a lot like that.
Yeah, you know, you raised, though those cases are not in my book, you raise an interesting issue, which is, let's say that someday, and I raised this question in the book, we don't need truck drivers anymore. Let's say that all the experimental driverless trucking that's going on right now in places and open stretches of highway in Texas and Arizona, we're not quite totally autonomous. We've got a driver sitting in the passenger seat ready to take over. There's a follow car, but the experiments are happening. We're going to get there. And the question becomes, okay, if it's not going to be the long-haul trucker who's grabbing a sex traffic victim to kill, where do serial killers end up going? And you've just cited a couple of examples where they're not going to stop. billing, but they'll have a different methodology. That you cited with going to a fast food place as they're closing is interesting, because there are similarities with the Highway Serial Killings Initiative, because you're buying time. When you do that killing and lock them in the freezer or the walk-in refrigerator, you now have hours before the place opens again in the morning. And during those hours, you're going to three or four states. You're gone. You're in the wind. And it's very difficult to capture you. So my assertion would be serial killers don't stop. That's why it's so troubling that there's 200 unsolved cases. But they will keep going and find a way.
We got to take another break. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about long-haul truckers, the ones who happen to be serial killers, how the FBI and police, DPS, are trying to track them down and solve these cases, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Frank Figluzzi, author of the new book, The Long Haul, Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. So, Frank, you got in the cab and you rode thousands of miles across America trying to gain insight into this world. It's a different world. What did you learn?
Oh, you've broken up there, David.
Yeah, okay. So, Frank, what did you learn when you rode in the cab thousands of miles?
Yeah, it is a different planet. And I can tell you this, it's not the Ritz-Carlton. I slept in the upper bunk of the sleeper berth. We ate many of our meals in the cab, sometimes cooking our meals in the cab. And it gets old. I passed the time often investigating where we were going, what we were picking up, and where we were dropping it off. And there were some surprises there. I felt very much a part of the economy. Our first load was a load of drywall from a gypsum factory. This is after COVID, and so we are part of the resurgence of the housing industry. People just couldn't wait to get the drywall at their construction company. Another load we carried was aluminum rods, and as I investigate the place we're going to drop it off at, which was in Wisconsin, I discover we're dropping it off at a highly secure Department of Defense ammunitions factory, where that will be aluminum will be turned into shell casings for the Army and the Navy. We had lumber for flooring. We carried a suicide coil, which is rolled, a very heavy roll of steel. That it's called a suicide coil because if you improperly chain it down and secure it, it can roll back into your cab and kill you, or worse, roll off the back of the trailer and kill people in their cars. So that part of it, that part of feeling like you're part of the economy, was great. The physical engagement with the load, these tarps that we had to cover our load with weigh 100 pounds. So we're tossing rolled tops up to the trailer and then up on top of our load to unfurl them over the load. You've got to know points of securement, weight distribution. Can we fill up our gas tanks today, or will that put us overweight? All of that was fascinating. And I came away with a positive impression. The young trucker that I was working with, if he's the future of trucking, then we're in good shape.
I guess that's young Mike that you're talking about.
That is Mike, who was a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and chose long-haul trucking because it offered him a six-figure income.
So young Mike shared with you a list of kind of rules to follow, road rules, and number one is don't empty your pee jug at the truck stop. Unpack that for us.
So there's a culture, a subculture that I deeply wanted to get into, and some of it may seem humorous, but there's certain things about professionalism and courtesy on the road that are essential, and one of them is keep a clean truck. About once a month, unless it's even dirtier, you're going to want to go to the truck wash and keep your company brand name looking sharp and shiny. You know, you do, not to get too graphic, but you do need to relieve yourself on the road. Often you don't want to take the time to stop. And that generally takes the form of using, you know, gallon jugs, and you do what you need to do, but don't empty those out at a truck stop. You know, don't be that person who does that. Do your disposal discreetly. There's lots of kind of rules of the road. You're always going to want to either flash your lights or honk your horn if someone shows courtesy and lets you in, or to cut in front of them. All of that is part of it, but some of it's quite scary. Look, we were 80,000 pounds fully loaded. And it was clear to me through some of the near misses that we had when I was driving, you know, car drivers largely oblivious because they're on the phone or talking, that, you know, we avoid killing people just by being vigilant. So if you think you're going to pass that truck on the entrance ramp or you're going to get out ahead of it, please understand something. They don't have that kind of acceleration when they're loaded. And you should not be trying to do that. Also, I can now look at a truck on the highway and tell whether the load is secured properly or not, and I will stay away, far away from an unsecured, a poorly secured load, and even a steel coil, a suicide coil that I think is properly loaded. I'm going nowhere near that. The other data that became clear to me is that anonymous surveys of truckers show that 10% of them admit drinking alcohol every day, 20% admit binge drinking 5 or more alcoholic drinks regularly, and 44% of truckers are signs of major clinical depression.
What can be done now to, now that we are aware of this problem of truckers, some of them who are serial killers, is there anything that can be done to make it more difficult for them or to keep them from becoming serial killers, from becoming truck drivers?
Yeah, I didn't want to just write the book that was a lot of scary stuff and walk away from it. I wanted to make sure that I included positive stories and also best practices and some suggestions moving forward, not only in the trucking industry, but for the area of anti-trafficking. There's plenty of suggestions in there. There's suggestions for law enforcement as well. With regard to the trucking industry, first of all, we've got to acknowledge long-haul truckers as the essential employees that they are. Pay them more money, recruit more assertively and confidently. But there's a challenge there. Do you know that legally, trucking companies are permitted to be second-chance employers? That means they can recruit and hire convicted felons. Now, I am a fan of reacclimating prisoners to employment in our society. I think that's a positive, and I think they become some of the most loyal employees. However, when you're making a deliberate strategy out of hiring ex-cons, as some companies do, by the way, I think it behooves you to get far more careful about vetting that driver and digging more deeply. I'm also a fan of cross training so that in a big company that drives different kinds of trucks, reefers, low boys, heavy loads, tankers, hazmat, getting people cross trained so that they're just not doing the dry van, that dry goods haul across the country that can be mind numbing. I think that kind of physical engagement with the other trucking could be very, very helpful. And then the training. You can throw in an hour of training to your commercial driver's license training on trafficking, and you could have truckers become the eyes and ears of the anti-trafficking movement, as some organizations do. The organization called Truckers Against Trafficking does that and gives awards for hero truckers every year.
But so if they're giving these second chances to felons, we don't want to take that away. That's an important thing to have in society, give people an opportunity to work their way back into society. But there should be extra screening. How would you employ something like that?
So I know people will cringe whenever I suggest that we need further government regulation, but I think this is an area where the Department of Transportation could get more
And did we lose the call? All right, he's there. We lost you for a second, Frank.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was suggesting that the Department of Transportation should be more involved in requiring far more thorough background checks, particularly of known felons, so that we might carve out violent histories from being eligible to do that. I also am a fan of making mandatory the GPS tracking of all trucks, not just the big company trucks, but even small owner operators. Tracking their load should be mandatory.
So you think having the public raise its awareness that the number one profession for a serial killer is a long-haul trucker, could that provide, you know, some vigilance in order to protecting people from these killers?
One hope that I have with this book, and I have several, but one of them would be, if nothing more than making people more vigilant and aware on the highway, and therefore more safer, this book would be a success. For example, you're traveling alone, particularly if you're female. Make sure your car is always gassed up. Don't pass that opportunity up, but don't go to the truck stop for that gas. Make sure you've thought about the getting gassed up. You don't want that emergency last minute gas up to take place at the truck stop or particularly at a truck side of a truck stop. I would find that cars only truck stop. I would also encourage people to call in to 911, excuse me, if they believe a truck is stalking them, bumper locking them from behind, signaling to them. If it makes you uncomfortable and your gut tells you something's wrong, pick up the phone, call 911, tell that state patrol where you are. Situational awareness at all times, right? I'm on I-75 North. I'm at mile marker 72. You should know that when you're going to pick up that phone. I encourage people to do that as well.
And could artificial intelligence or some sort of quantum computing really kind of crack these cases? If we had the data, we could tell how many truckers, which trucker was in around places where these things happened a lot.
There's no question that AI can be a friend here and can help crunch the volume of big data that is ingested in some of these investigations. I think that's the future. Technology is our friend, but also, as I said, the technology is where the sex transactions are being advertised,
right,
and it's where grooming and recruiting is happening as well.
Frank Figluzzi is the author of the new book, Long Haul Hunting the Highway Serial Killers. Thanks for coming on today, Frank. We appreciate your work, everything that you do, and this new book.
Thanks for getting the word out. Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.